Hi, friends. We're Luke and Christina Middendorf. I serve as the president of Family Life, and we're so glad you're joining us for Family Life today. Did you know that 40% of our ministry support comes in at the end of the year? That's why your gift right now makes such a difference.
And this month, every donation you give is matched dollar for dollar. Your generosity helps families experience the gospel and see God's faithfulness in their story. You can give at familylifetoday.com or call 800-FL-TODAY.
There's a well-worn sort of phrase that goes, you can win an argument and lose a person. I think that's true. I think that's what 1 Peter 3:15 is trying to say to you. It's like, yes, there are occasions when, you know, you as a Christian apologist or evangelist, you could sort of quote unquote demolish the other person intellectually, maybe. But if you've done that in such a sort of aggressive, demeaning, ridiculing way, they wouldn't want what you're offering anyway. That's where you've lost it. You've lost the person, even if you've won the argument.
Welcome to Family Life Today, where we want to help you pursue the relationships that matter most. I'm Ann Wilson.
And I'm Dave Wilson, and you can find us at familylifetoday.com. This is Family Life Today. Well, we get a second day with Justin Brierley.
I know. I'm looking forward to this because I love this guy. I love what he's doing.
I love when a Christian can engage our brain to use our minds that God gave us to understand not only life, but theology and how to parent and bring these conversations into our home. His book is Why I'm Still a Christian. We get to ask him some questions about why is he still a Christian?
And because he's had conversations for two decades with skeptics and atheists, and he's been defending his faith. So it's an interesting conversation.
Hey, you've watched and debated, you know, atheists, skeptics. So here's my question. What advice do you give to Christ followers? Again, a lot of our listeners and watchers are moms and dads and husbands and wives who are at a workplace on a ball diamond with their other kids. And, you know, maybe a conversation will start with somebody that's an atheist or a skeptic. You've watched these conversations, and the way that conversation goes is critical, not just answering questions with, intelligence and evidence and apologetics, but actually how the conversation goes. What have you learned, like to coach us that are out in the real world and we don't have PhDs and we didn't go to Oxford, and yet we want to be able to honor our faith and our belief, and we want to have a loving conversation with somebody.
A respectful one.
That goes well. You've watched this. You've done this. Coach us up. How do we have these conversations?
There's going to be different approaches for different personalities, but on average, you know, I would point back to that 1 Peter 3:15 passage, which in a way was always the motto of the show, which is always be ready to give an answer to anyone who asks you about the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect, that wherever these conversations go, whatever form they take, we're encouraged, we're commanded really, to have them in Christ-like ways, gentleness and respect. So whether you feel like you're winning or losing an argument, let's make sure that you don't, if you like, lose the person by acting in an arrogant, aggressive, rude way towards them, because then you probably are shutting off the possibility of continuing the conversation at a later stage. I always want any conversation to end with the possibility of us picking this up again at some point, because people are never won or lost in a single argument. It's always, you know, a series of engagements. And of course, the way you act as much as the things you say that are making an impression on that skeptic or atheist or whoever it may be. That's absolutely critical, the grace and respect that we're commanded in 1 Peter 3:15. But then of course, it is about having reasons for the hope that you have. So, you know, if you're being asked questions, then it makes sense to go and do some study. If there are questions that someone's asking you, that's assuming there's a kind of an ongoing relationship probably with this person where they're asking you something and maybe you don't know, and that's fine. It's okay to say, I don't know. But would you mind if I go away and look into it and come back and we'll continue this conversation? And I think people respect that, honestly. I think they often respect that more than you kind of pretending to know things you don't necessarily know, because that's where you can really come unstuck if you're trying to make out you know more than you actually do. So be humble, but try to encourage those conversations to continue. And the other thing I would say is there's always temptation when we're speaking, you know, as a Christian, perhaps, you know, really hoping to convince and persuade the person opposite us of our faith. There's a temptation sometimes to not listen to what they're saying, just to be there to kind of put your point across and make sure, you know, you ram your particular message home. And I think that can be actually quite off-putting to the person on the receiving end of that if they feel like they're just there as a sort of project or a... I think the best kinds of conversations tend to be ones where you're genuinely listening and taking in what that person's saying, hearing what they have to say, being open to taking that on board and changing the way you would respond to them. And that's why I would say one of the most important things you can do in a conversation is not just to answer somebody's questions, but to ask your own questions of them. Ask them why they believe what they believe. How did they come to those conclusions growing up? Is there a purpose to life? You know, you may have a view on that. Ask them what they think the purpose of life is. You might find you're having a whole different conversation, in fact, which kind of opens up things maybe that person hasn't actually thought of before. And so I think it's always going to be two-way. The best conversations, you know, are in both directions, where they may be asking important questions about your faith, but you kind of get to ask questions about their worldview as well. And that's just as important in that way.
Yeah, I've always found it interesting, as you quoted 1 Peter, that he says to be ready to give a defense to everyone. That's a person. It's not every argument or every, you know, pushback. It's a person that you're talking to show gentleness and respect. And it's just what you just said. It's very, I'll never forget early, I was a church planner 30 some years ago, and we started this church and it started growing. And I don't know, maybe the first year, second year in, we were doing something on the weekend on apologetics and defending your faith. And I make a comment in the first of probably three sermons. I'm going to give this same sermon three or four times today. I make a comment about another religion and say, can you believe those people believe this? And then I go on. And this guy comes up to me in between services and goes, and he wasn't on our staff, but he was very involved in our church. Young guy, he's probably 20-something. And he goes, hey, my mom is in that religion that you said, can you believe they think this? And she's coming to church next week. Do you understand how that comment is going to make her feel? And I looked at him and I said, now I do. Oh my goodness. I am so sorry. That was so disrespectful.
And arrogant.
So arrogant, so prideful. Like, we are so much better thinkers than these ridiculous people. And I was like, thank you for that comment. It was just so wrong. And it changed the way I approach preaching. And, you know, like you said, having a conversation with anybody that thinks differently than me, humbly. Love them and respect them and draw them out, like you said, with questions to say, tell me more, and you'll win their respect.
And this was one of the things I found over the years of hosting these conversations with atheists and Christians was, yes, it was often encouraging for Christians to hear the faith kind of being defended against, you know, a significant atheist voice. But actually, I also made friends with a lot of atheists and agnostics in that time, both those who came on the show and people who were regular listeners via the podcast. And the reason they became friends was because they felt they were being genuinely, as I say, listened to, respected in the conversations. They weren't being sort of just straw men were being erected to be knocked down. I was trying to find their best spokespeople to come on and have these conversations. And so it led to, as I say, a lot of barriers actually breaking down, because I think sometimes some of those skeptics had been only exposed to Christians or apologists or evangelists who had sort of been very dismissive of atheism or whatever. But taking it seriously and taking their questions seriously, I think enabled them to take Christianity seriously, interestingly, enable them to say, well, if he's done us the service of taking our point of view seriously, I'm going to give him the time of day as well. And that led, as I say, to some really constructive relationships and much, much healthier conversations in the end.
Yeah, it's hard to like the message if you don't like the messenger.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to say we didn't have very robust disagreements, you know.
Right.
I'm not saying you have to kind of peddle your faith lightly or anything like that. But I think it's about an atmosphere of respect for the people, even if you disagree with their views. It's about making sure that they know that you're engaging their arguments rather than them or their character. You know, let's be respectful of that people are genuinely trying to search for the truth, even if we disagree with their conclusions. And that can often be, you know, a good step towards a better conversation.
You were in studio with us the last time with your son. And one of the things I remember about both of you was that fact that you're very interested in all of us, incredibly humble, kind, and genuinely asking questions. And there's an openness when you find that kind of respect. You honored everybody that was with you, and your son did as well, the one that just got married, Noah. He was the one with you, right?
He was, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a great trip. Yeah, it was great fun.
And I could tell by your son what kind of dad you were. Anybody would probably open their lives and their hearts to having a genuine conversation based on your respectfulness of each other.
I'm very glad to hear that that was the impression that we gave. I'm not saying we've always been the best role models by any stretch with our kids, but we have genuinely tried to model, hopefully, that grace and respect that 1 Peter 3:15 talks about, gentleness and respect. I think that also comes across to the people that you're also talking to in the end as well.
Yes.
It's about making sure that you don't close the door, as I said, to that conversation. There's a well-worn sort of phrase that goes, you can win an argument and lose a person. I think that's true. I think that's what 1 Peter 3:15 is trying to say to you. It's like, yes, there are occasions when, you know, you as a Christian apologist or evangelist, you could sort of quote unquote demolish the other person intellectually, maybe. But if you've done that in such a sort of aggressive, demeaning, ridiculing way that they wouldn't want what you're offering anyway, if that's the kind of person you are, then I think, yeah, that's where you've lost it. You've lost the person, even if you've won the argument. And we're ultimately about winning people, not winning arguments. That's what we're called to do, you know?
Well, I loved how you framed your thinking in this book about how, you know, why I'm still a Christian. God makes sense of, and you have different areas. We can walk through some of them, but when you think of, okay, God makes the best sense of these different areas. Pick anyone you want. I mean, I don't know if there's a top three or five, but I mean, you open up with human existence, you know?
Yeah.
Walk us through.
I very often, if I'm being asked to kind of present some of the core reasons for why I think it makes sense to believe in God specifically, I'll point to three things. And these are the three of the chapters in the book. The first one is human existence, as you said. The second one is human value. And the third one is human purpose. These are three aspects of our experience that I believe point to God and point away from atheism, the idea that there's no God. And it's not that I have to kind of prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Christianity is true to my skeptical friends and neighbors. It's more that we're comparing and contrasting the things we both believe. Okay, so if I'm speaking to an atheist who doesn't believe there's a God, who believes, if you like, that this universe runs according to purely mechanical, material processes, that there's nothing more going on beyond that, I guess what I'm saying is, well, if you take that view that we call naturalism, atheism, whatever, and we compare it to the view that there is a God behind the universe, there is a sort of divine mind from which all of this springs, whose view is best supported by the evidence that's actually available to all of us? What I find in doing this is that the evidence seems to better fit the Christian view that there is a God than the atheist view that it's all just blind processes and material stuff that's happening. And so the first place is human existence. The fact we're here at all seems to me to comport much better with the idea that there's a divine mind behind the universe than that there's nothing there, that we're here by the results of blind chance, essentially. And I could point to a number of different things here, but the very thing that's often been used to beat Christians with, science, is actually one of the things that is, I think, most extraordinarily pointing towards the idea of a God, a divine mind behind the universe. Because when you look at what it took, just at a scientific level, for humans to exist, it seems to me that it's very hard to continue to believe that we're here by the result of pure chance. So there's this phenomenon called the fine-tuning of the universe for life. If you're not familiar with that, I'll try to explain it very briefly, but it's the idea that when the universe came into existence, which is itself a rather remarkable fact, it was birthed with exactly the right values and parameters of the laws, such as the force of gravity, the ratio of electrons to protons in the universe. There's about 30 or 40 of these fundamental numbers, basically, that had to be dialed to just the right number, if you will, to allow chemistry, planets, galaxies, stars, and ultimately humans to exist at some point in this cosmos. And if any one of those, if you like, numbers had differed from its actual value by an infinitesimally small degree, then we wouldn't have life. We would have a universe that is completely inhospitable to the possibility of you and me. So the very fact we're here and that the universe appears to have been set up so incredibly precisely to allow life to appear, it looks like something's going on. That does not appear to confirm the atheist view that we're here by chance. Mm. It seems much more likely that there's some kind of a designer involved, basically. In the book, I go through obviously some of the objections and responses to this view, but it is fascinating that the more we know about the universe, rather than kind of excluding God, it appears that it's actually raising the God question much more. So I've met so many secular scientists who have said, this is the one thing that gives me pause, that maybe there's more going on in our universe than just blind physics and chemistry, because the chemistry itself depends on this incredible fine-tuning at the beginning of it all. So this is just one area. And for some of my friends, you know, this is a great way in to talking about God, because they love talking about mathematics and science and the physics of the universe. For other people, it'll leave them completely cold, obviously, and this may not be the place to begin. But for a lot of people I know, this is the tantalizing thing that opens up the God question.
In my experience of preaching about this, and, you know, it's not every week, but every once in a while, I'll dive into this, and I'm not an expert like you, but I can read your books and I can pull up some of the dials. And I can remember doing several sermons on this in the last 10 years about the science side of why I believe this makes sense, just like you.
I remember it, because even if you say if the sun were just a little bit closer or a little further from the earth, we would either be burning up or freezing.
You adjust any one of those dials, and you know better than I do. But here's what I found fascinating. I walk off the stage, and guess who runs up and really wants to talk and not debate me, but hear more? They want to learn more. It's the next generation.
Yeah, it's the young people,
it's
isn't it?
It's the younger generation. Yeah. The older are like, okay, good, thank you very much, I'm going home. And the 15 and 18 and 20 and 25-year-olds are like, this is fascinating. Can we discuss more? I have never heard this.
I get exactly the same reaction, Dave, when I do this in schools or youth settings. They love this because it feels like, oh, this is kind of like, this relates to what they're actually learning in school.
Yes.
It's like suddenly God and Christianity isn't this separate thing that's sort of somehow excluded from science and things. It's like, it's involved. I have a particular video that's had a couple of million views now over the years. It's called How a Dice Can Show That God Exists. And I use the analogy of throwing a dice. What are the odds, if you like, of throwing 70 sixes in a row? Well, it turns out it's something like 1 in 10 to the 60, okay? A hugely improbable thing to throw 70 times in a row. And I liken this to the odds of the expansion rate of the universe, one of these cosmological dials, if you like, being just right for the emergence of life. And I say, basically, the odds are the same. If it differed from its actual value by 1 part in 10 to the 60, then we wouldn't have life. Now, that short video is about 4 minutes long. Whenever I play it in a kind of public presentation, that's the thing that the young people come after and say, where can I get that video? I want to show that to my friend. Just for whatever reason, it really kind of, you know, for some people, it's the thing that kind of turns them onto the whole thing.
I would want a link to that video, which we'll put in our show notes. And I would play that at the dinner table and then have a discussion.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could do this on each of your chapters of say, here's the topic. Maybe you don't do it every night, but once a week, here's the topic for the night. Mm. And if you have teenagers or even elementary school kids, they're going to engage in this. And it's going to give them some tools to put in their pocket to defend their faith. I think it's a fascinating discussion. And what you talk about and write about is fascinating.
All right, let's talk the second H, human value.
Okay, human value. I mean, this goes from looking out there in the universe to looking within. And it's more about, why do we believe in things like human rights? Why do we believe in the equality and dignity and value of every single person? It's a question about essentially morality. Why do we believe that there are some right ways to treat other human beings and some wrong ways to treat other human beings? Now, my atheist friend may say, well, just because it helps us to get along in a society, you know, it's just the way our culture has evolved or whatever. The problem is that that isn't always the way cultures have evolved. There have been lots of cultures in the past where people could be slaves where women were very much second-class citizens to men, where the lives of children were cheap and dispensable. The fact is, this idea of human rights, equality, value, dignity, that is so commonplace now in Western culture, it came from somewhere. And it's very hard to understand that very concept of value, dignity, and morality, full stop, without there being a God. Now, this is a bit more of a philosophical argument, okay? So to some extent, whether this is helpful for someone will depend a little bit on their temperament. But for me, it is a very powerful argument. In fact, coming back to our friend C.S. Lewis, this is the argument that really convinced him that God existed, that moved him from atheism to believing in God. It's the argument from morality. He said, you know, famously in Mere Christianity, you know, one of my arguments against God was that the universe was so unjust. But he said, where had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. He said, what he's saying is, if you believe in right and wrong, justice and injustice, you can't have those concepts in a universe without God. All you've got in a universe without God is just whatever happens, whatever nature throws up. And so if that happens to be a culture where some people are slaves and where women are second-class citizens, then that's just the way it is. There's no moral law. There just is whatever nature produces. But most of us don't feel like that. And C.S. Lewis didn't feel like that. He felt, no, there really are right and wrong ways we should treat each other. That's something we've discovered. It's not something we've invented. It's sort of baked in. And if you believe that, if you believe there are really right and wrong ways to treat each other, that human rights exist in reality, they're not just something we've invented, then you should believe in God. And the reason for that is because this realm, if you like, of moral laws cannot exist in a universe that is actually just composed of atoms and electrons. If atoms and electrons is all that exists, then morality is just whatever we happen to have cooked up in our brains. And it's just another result of atoms and electrons. There's no right or wrong. Could have gone a very different way, and it has in previous cultures and in cultures today, let's be honest. But if you believe there are such things as right and wrong, that some cultures who enslave, treat women badly and everything else are wrong to do that, then you have to appeal to something outside of nature. You have to appeal to a moral law that exists beyond the atoms and electrons of nature. And that means there has to be a lawgiver, something beyond nature, a supernature. My best explanation for that is that there's a God who is, if you like, baked into reality, this moral law that we are all subject to. Very often this argument only really strikes atheists and skeptics when they're actually confronted with real moral evil. That's been my experience. So I think very often a lot of the skeptics I've met are kind of happy to sort of say, well, it's all just ultimately evolution and psychology and social engineering or whatever. But when their daughter gets raped, I know that's an awful example to use, but let's be honest, this happens in the world. They suddenly come face to face with the fact that they cannot treat that as just the way the world is, the way nature is. They know that something wrong has happened. And their sense of injustice and anger, it's coming from a place where they recognize this is not the way the world should be. If you don't think the world should be this way, that means there's a way the world should be. Mm. And that means there's a God behind it who's kind of embedded a moral law, which when we come up against it, we know there's something deeper here, that there's something more than just chemistry going on. So for me, that's something that is both a philosophical argument, but also something I think people often encounter at an experiential level as well.
Okay, so what do you think of our conversation with Justin
today? I just love that I'm thinking that we're using our brain. Again, I said it earlier that, you know, I always thought Christians were just naive and gullible, and they didn't really use their brains. And Justin's proven, you know, when you have a brain that God gave you, you're supposed to use it to reason and think, and Christianity makes sense.
But he also is kind and respectful in how he engages in a conversation. I just think he's masterful. And you can tell that he loves Jesus.
Yeah, so pick up his book, Why I'm Still a Christian. It's in the show notes at our website, familylifetoday.com. And by the way, if you want to watch this whole conversation on YouTube, you know, you can search Family Life Today on YouTube, and you get to see my really cool blue hoodie I'm wearing today. You don't get to see that on the audio, you get to see it on the video.
You get to watch the whole conversation. We would love to pray for you. I would personally love to pray for you. And we even have a team at Family Life that can pray for you. Just go to familylife.com/prayforme.
Family Life Today is a donor-supported ministry of Family Life, a crew ministry, helping you pursue the relationships that matter most.